Good morning to everybody. Thank you, Rabbi Winter, and to the Greater Washington Community Kollel, to Young Israel Shomer Emunah for hosting this event. This is the second part of what has become a series on the topic of Minhagim. I was asked to briefly summarize what I discussed last time, and maybe I'll look to the audience for somebody to do that. Really, this is a separate topic completely from the first topic that I spoke about. The first time we met, I really discussed a broad sketch of Minhagim, the source of Minhagim, why Minhagim are so important. I had mentioned that some Rishonim actually note that the word Minhag rejumbled is Gehenim, and the basis for that is that if a Minhag has a source, then it can last in perpetuity. If a Minhag does not have a source, really, the difficulty and the complication in its serving as a basis for halacha and practice is much to be challenged. Let me begin with two anecdotes, and I think it will serve as somewhat of a bridge and transition from the last talk to this talk, and I hope will serve as a stepping stone for what I'd like to really, really work with you this morning. There is a figure today, Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky. He's a grandson of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichron Leracha. He's a principal, a dean, Rosh Yeshiva in the Long Island. His early career started as a rabbi in Pittsburgh. I think in Paul Eitz Tzedek was the name of the shul, a very old-standing, long-time synagogue. And Rabbi Kamenetsky came to serve as the rabbi during this period in between Pesach and Shavuos. Interestingly enough, his first Shabbos that he was serving as rabbi of the synagogue was Shabbos Mevarchim Iyar. That is the Shabbos that we just had 3 weeks ago or so. Shabbos Mevarchim Iyar, of course, is referred to as Shabbos Mevarchim, and on the calendar, there are 11 times a year that we bench Rosh Chodesh, the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh, and typically on that Shabbos, the chapter and the passage of Acharav Avarachamim is skipped. The reason that it's skipped is because Avarachamim was instituted to commemorate the death of thousands and thousands of Jews during the time of the Crusades, and in such a happy day, Shabbos Mevarchim, we're ushering in the new month, it wouldn't be appropriate to say it. So Rabbi Kamenetsky stood up and was asked to daven. His first Shabbos as the rabbi, he gets up to the pulpit and he's preparing himself to daven, and things are going just splendidly. And he gets to Avarachamim, and all of a sudden he says Av, and the congregation bursts into an awesome and incredible fight. The president yells out, "We don't say Avarachamim." The vice president says, "We do say Avarachamim." The treasurer says, "You don't know what you're talking about." The gabbai says, "You don't remember anything." And there's a brawl ensuing, and the rabbi is looking, this new minted rabbi, he doesn't know what to do with himself. 3 minutes go by, 4 minutes go by, and the fight is increasing with intensity. Slowly he looks around and begins to see the entire people start smiling, and there's a bit of a smirk emerging from everybody's face. The rabbi is even more perplexed. He turns and he sees the older shamus in the back. And the older shamus is sitting there very calmly, very collected, and very cool. And he walks over to the back of the shul and asks the shamus, who's in his late 80s, and says to him, "What's the minhag here? What's the custom? This is a shul of close to a century old. Tell me, what's the minhag? Yes, Avarachamim, no Avarachamim. Why is everybody fighting?" So the shamus looks at him and says, "This is the minhag. We fight about it." So, minhagim have a certain power and flair to them. Sometimes we're very passionate about minhagim, to do or not to do, and sometimes the minhag is to fight. Let me share with you, I guess, a little bit of a joke, but the joke has a particular power to it. Rosh Hashiva of the last generation used to quip. There was a minister, a priest, and a rabbi who got together, and in the sake of tolerance, unity, camaraderie, thought that they would try to forgive and do away with some of their classic dogmas and their chief principles of their religion, and in the spirit of tolerance, they would be able to come together. So the priest begins and turns to the rabbi, and the minister says, "We're willing to do away with Immaculate Conception." The people are stunned. They can't believe it. The minister, the rabbi, Immaculate Conception, how are you going to continue? Says the priest, after he hears what the minister says, "You know what? We'll do away with the Trinity." The rabbi is stuck. The Trinity's gone. Immaculate Conception is finished. The rabbi says, "What am I going to do?" So the rabbi turns to him and says, "We're going to do away with the second Yukum Purkan before Musaf on Shabbos." Those of you not familiar, Yukum Purkan is a passage or two passages which are cited right before Avarachamim, actually. And it's interesting to note, it's actually the subject of serious polemics in the 19th century between the Orthodox and Reform. The Reform movement wanted to do away with the second Yukum Purkan. So the rabbi was sort of joking that if you're willing to do away with the Trinity and Immaculate Conception, we'll do away with the Yochum Purkum. But it speaks to the seriousness and the nature which we take Minhagim. That which the Trinity and Immaculate Conception mean to another religion, the minhag to recite Yochum Purkum is just as significant. So Minhagim and the strength of Minhagim are awesome, are powerful. What I'd like to do this morning is to try to understand when and how and if ever Minhagim can be abolished. That will be the topic of this morning's discussion. Specifically, I like to contrast communal Minhagim, Minhagei Tzibur, to familial Minhagim, Minhagei Mishpacha. We all know, and I'm sure if I would raise your hands, I would ask you to raise your hands in this room, you have multiple different Minhagim within your families. Pesach just passed, and we're talking about the Seder. Every individual, every family has their own set of Minhagim. Now, if I just came in 10, 20, 40, 50 years later into this family, am I still bound to that minhag? Do I have to run around the table with the afikomen? Do I have to hide the afikomen? Do I have to make knedelach? Can I not make knedelach? I mean, how bound are we to family customs? On the other hand, the same thing is true when it comes to communal customs, minhagei tzibur. If I come into a community, I move into a particular town or to a particular city, am I subject to keep those particular customs, the minhag of the city? How much leniency, how much weight is there keeping family minhagim versus keeping communal customs? These two areas of minhagim really are the primary areas where minhagim are discussed. As I mentioned last time, the source of minhagim in Chazal is really the fourth chapter, Maseches Pesachim, Perek Makom Shenagu. And there, the Gemara and the Mishnah, the Tanaim and the Amoraim, discuss at great length various minhagim. These minhagim have become citywide, city practice minhagim, and some of them become familial minhagim. We really need to understand is what keeps and what, if anything, will bind us to keep to these particular customs. I'd like to start by looking at sources 1 and 2. Two passages, the first, a Gemara Maseches Pesachim, the second, a Gemara Maseches Chulin, that really speak to the nature of customs in general and the enforceability of customs in general. The Gemara says in source number 1, B'nai Baishan, that was a group of people from the city of Baishan, had a particular custom. What was their custom? Nahug dulo azlinan mitzur litzidan b'male shabbata. They wouldn't travel from the city of Tzur to the city of Sidon on Erev Shabbos, presumably because they didn't want to get caught in traffic. And if they would get caught in traffic, they wouldn't be able to make it home. So the custom developed for the people of the city not to travel, not to do business on that day of Erev Shabbos. That's what the Gemara says. The city of Baishan, the people of Baishan, had this custom not to travel from Tzur to Sidon on Erev Shabbos. Came along their children. Asu b'nayahu, their children of the city, of the people of Baishan, came in front of Rabbi Yochanan, Amarlo, avusun efshelahu, analo efshelan. Our fathers, our parents and our grandparents were able to stand by this custom with tooth and nail. They were able to commit to this practice and they kept this practice. Business is tough. Times are hard. We can't keep up the customs of our forefathers. Our ancestors were pious. They were terrific. They were able to keep this custom. They established this custom. We can't. We're unable to. Can we uproot this custom? Are we permitted? And what is the propriety of dropping the custom of not traveling from Tzur to Tzidon to go to the marketplace in Erev Shabbos? What did Rabbi Yochanan respond? The second line, source number one, Amar lahu, kfar kiblu avoseichem alehem. You don't have a choice. Your ancestors already accepted this custom. You have no right to renege. You have no right to uproot. You have no right to stop keeping this custom. And Rabbi Yochanan cited them the pasuk in Mishlei, Shenemar, Shema b'ni musar avicha val titosh taras imecha. This pasuk is used to describe and to prove Rabbi Yochanan's point. Hearken to the words, the rebuke of your father, and listen to the musar of your mother. This is one of the biblical sources that is brought, although it's not in Torah or Nevi'im, it's a pasuk in Ksuvim and Mishlei. Nonetheless, the Gemara in Rabbi Yochanan uses this text proof to teach the people of the city of Baishan that they had no right, it was an impossibility for them, and they could not stop keeping the custom that their ancestors kept. Thus, from source number one, the Gemara Pesachim, on Daf Nun Amabez, it emerges that one has no right to stop a family custom, family customs which were instituted, and which were instituted on a serious level and were kept, at least on some level for a significant amount of time, cannot be abolished. Take a look in source number two. Gemara and Chulin and Daf Kufhei Amir Aleph. Gemara says, Amar Mar Ukva. Ano lahamilsa chalabar chamra legabe ava. I am like vinegar, the son of wine, compared to my father. Why? Di'ilu Abba. Ki havi achil bisra idna, lo havi achil gvina ad lamachar. My father was such a pious man that when he ate meat at 1 in the afternoon on Tuesday, wouldn't eat milk until 1 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. A full day. That's significant. 24 hours. Not 1, not 3, not into the 6, not 6. 24 hours, says Mar Ukva, that he is like vinegar compared to wine, because his father kept very serious stringency to not eat milk after he ate meat for 24 hours. V'ilu ana, but me, said Mar Ukva, ana bahasu udasuhu dula achilna. I won't eat milk with meat at the same meal. Ulesudasa achrina achilna. But at the next meal, I have no problem eating milk. The Gemara indicates here that a father and a son, parents and children, seemingly can change their custom. Because here Mar Ukva comments that his father had the practice and the custom of not eating milk after meat for 24 hours, but his son changed that. He didn't go in front of Rabbi Yochanan, he didn't ask a rabbi if it's okay to switch the custom, but he simply changed that, and explicitly, the Gemara says, without asking, simply said, Ana bahasudasu dula achilna, lusudas achrina achilna. One meal I won't eat meat, but the next meat I will certainly eat milk. Parenthetically, this is the source of the separation between eating meat and milk, and the Rishonim here debate, what does it mean from one meal to another meal? And that's the reason why many of you in this room may have different customs, by the way, in terms of waiting from meat to milk, because what does it mean from one meal to another meal? Some people eat a meal every hour. Those of you who may have gone to a Pesach hotel, you eat constantly. There's no separation. Some wait 3 hours, some wait into the 6th hour, some wait 6 hours, because the custom that developed was based upon reconciling and understanding this Gemara. What does it mean from one meal to another meal? That's not the subject of our discussion. The subject of our discussion is really this morning going to reconcile these two passages, to understand what the pshat in these two Gemaras are. How could it be that the Gemara Maseches Pesachim teaches that one is prohibited from changing a custom from family to family? The Bnei Bayishan were prohibited. Their ancestors kept a particular practice with its strength, and the enforcement seemed to have kept from generation to generation for posterity. Rabbi Yochanan commented from the Pasuk, Shema mini busa avicha val titosh toras imecha, that you're prohibited from changing your family's custom. But on the other hand, the Gemara says that Mar Ukva had a very different familial practice than his father, who waited an entire 24 hours, the whole day cycle, before eating milk, as opposed to him who stopped eating from one meal to another meal. Our discussion this morning will really very much hinge upon reconciling this issue. I'd like to share with you what is the classical approach that the Achronim have to answer this difficulty and to try to reconcile these two Gemaras. You'll see sources 3 and 4, the Pri Chadash and the Chavos Yar, Pri Chadash Rabbi Chizkiya de Silvia, Shut Chavos Yar, Rabbi Yair Bachrach, two of the great Achronim, recognize the discrepancy and the contradiction between these two Gemaras, and suggest the following monumental difference, which will serve as a very, very paramount distinction between customs in general. Pri Chadash says as follows. The Gemara says in source number 1, Bnei Bayishan. Who are these Bnei Bayishan? Who are they? Who are these people? So Pri Chadash and the Chavos Yar suggest that it's not talking about a family, it's talking about the city. Bnei Bayishan were members of a city. And it's not that a family accepted a practice not to travel from Tzur to Tzidon on Erev Shabbos, but it was a communal institution of the entire city of Bayishan. And thus, when a community institutes with its rabbinic leaders a particular custom, that custom can never be tinkered and toyed with. And no later generation, and no descendants of that city, and no members who enter that city can abolish that custom, because the custom was established on a citywide practice and on a large scale. And anytime a citywide practice is instituted, nobody has the right to toy and to tinker with that particular custom. On the other hand, the Gemara in source number 2, Mar Ukva, that was a familial practice. And a father and a son, parents and children, it would be indicative, says the Pri Chadash and the Chavos Yair, that children can change customs of their parents for good reason, if there is need to do so. Thus, we have a categorical difference based upon sources 1 and 2, noted by the Pri Chadash and the Chavos Yair, that there's something called Minag Ha'ir, there's something called a city custom, there's something called Minag Mishpacha, a familial custom. Citywide Minhagim can never be abolished if their institution is carried out with strength and enforcement of the rabbinical leaders and is accepted by the city people. As opposed to familial customs, if a parent, if families have particular customs, it's not as charged and it doesn't have the strength that a citywide custom, and if there is good reason to abolish it, it can be abolished, i.e., note the Gemara in source number 2 with Mar Ukva, he couldn't manage to wait 24 hours. It's an impossibility for him. He couldn't handle, he couldn't tolerate waiting 24 hours from meat to milk, and thus he was able to skip to go from meal to meal. This is the general and the banner to respond and to reconcile these two passages. What we have to do this morning is to really focus a little bit more on city customs, to focus more on familial customs, and therefore to recognize, understand the parameters as to when this can happen or not. Source number 4, the Chavos Yair, was asked the following question. An individual, and this is printed in his Tshuva Siman Kuf Chavav, an individual asked the Chavos Yair, Rabbi Bachrach, that his father had the practice to fast every Monday and Thursday. Many of us are not as familiar with that custom, but there were pious individuals for generations who would fast part of Monday and Thursday. Monday and Thursday is the day that Tachnun, the longer Tachnun, is recited. Those who have the custom to recite Bahab on the Monday and Thursday and Monday following Sukkot and Pesach are familiar that Monday and Thursday has a level of seriousness in terms of the heightened level of din that exists on Monday and Thursday. And this individual said that it was his father's practice to fast every Monday and Thursday. And the fellow turned to the Chavos Yair and asked him, am I bound to that custom? Do I have to keep that? My father did that. Does that mean I have to do that? The Chavos Yair goes through the literature that I just shared with you, specifically sources 1 and 2, the Gemara in Chulin and the Gemara in Pesachim, and notes that there's a categorical difference between Minag Ha'ir and Minag Mishpacha, and he says, you see Mar Ukva. Mar Ukva changed his father's custom. His father fasted. His father didn't eat meat from milk for 24 hours, but his son stopped it. Therefore, says the Chavos Yair, if your practice of your father was to fast on Mondays and Thursdays, you are not bound to it if you have a good reason to stop the custom. And the fellow explained to him, I can't manage. It's an impossibility. There's no way for me to maintain my level of clarity by if I'm to fast on Monday and Thursday. And therefore, the Chavos Yair said, that's a good enough reason to stop the practice. It's important to note that although we see that familial customs, minhagei mishpacha, have a lower level of enforceability than minhagei ha'ir, nonetheless, it's not so fast that you could just do away with them. And the Chavos Yair notes that there are two particular parameters and two caveats to letting go of a familial custom. The first, he says, that if a child accepts the custom of his parents and keeps it once, that's it. Once you keep it once, post bar bas mitzvah, at that point, you can't let it go. Now, if you find a reason that you need to let it go, you'll need what's called hataras nadarim. You have to present yourself in front of a beis din and explain to the beis din why you can't keep it anymore. So it's not that you could just drop it, close the door and say, I'm finished with my family's custom. There needs to be good reason and good basis to do that. Furthermore, the Chavos Yair notes, and this is the psak of the Shulchan, as well, Shulchan Aruch as well, in Hilchos Nedarim, if somebody accepts the custom upon themselves three times, even without knowledge of keeping that custom, it's as if they've accepted upon it themselves, and therefore, after that, again, one would have to present themselves in front of a beis din to ask the beis din permission to drop that custom itself. But nonetheless, you do see very, very strong sources, both in the Chavos Yair and in the Pri Chadash, based upon reconciling sources 1 and 2 to describe and to decipher and to understand what the difference is categorically between family customs and city customs. Let me talk to you about particular customs that I believe will help you understand the strength of a city custom as opposed to a family custom. Over the years, we just finished the holiday of Pesach, the minhag of kitnius has always been and received significant pressure from various sects to abolish it. The reason for the institution of kitnius, as we're all familiar, the minhag of Ashkenaz, not to eat kitnius and Pesach. Kitnius are grain legumes that may grow in close proximity to wheat, and the rabbis of Ashkenaz, 1,000 years ago, prohibited all of these particular foods to be eaten because of concern that consumption of them would cause one to eat wheat and produce that is prohibited to be eaten on Pesach. The Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Emden, in his Sefer Mor Kitzia, wrote that if his father, the Chacham Tzvi, had the power, and if he would find enough rabbis to abolish this custom, he would have abolished it. That's what the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Yaakov Emden, quoting his father, said. Now, the Chacham Tzvi never found enough rabbis that were willing to say that we have to stop this custom, because no rabbis were willing to take that upon themselves. If the Rishonim and the Gaonim established this as a minhag of Ashkenaz, how can we abolish this particular custom if there's not everybody's going to do it? The only way, says Rav Yaakov Emden, quoting his father, that I would be willing to entertain the possibility of abolishing this particular custom is if indeed all of the rabbis of Ashkenaz would come together and convene and sit as a Beis Din and would understand that there's room to do so. Historically, it's very interesting to note that in the early 1800s, that was the most significant time where there was a very strong push to abolish kitnias. A student of Moses Mendelssohn, I think in the year 1807, 1808, in Westphalia, came up with a very powerful reason to stop the custom of kitnias. Three of the great rabbis of that era, Rabbi Yaakov Lowenbaum, the Nesivus, the rabbi in Lisa, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the author of the Chasam Sofer, the rabbi in Pressburg, and the rabbi of the Nesivus, the Chasam Sofer, and Rav Elazar Fleklis, the rabbi of Prague, who also authored the Tshuva Mi'ava, the three of them wrote very powerful responsa, responding to this student of Mendelssohn, saying that you can't abolish customs that existed and that were instituted by a city rabbinate. And when a city rabbinate institutes a particular custom, it's not something that could be abolished. Therefore, they squashed his reasoning for wanting to simply do away with the minhag of kitnias, and this custom continues throughout the generations. It's not new, but almost every 10, 15, 20, 30 years, you hear of somebody who wants to abolish kitnias. If you take a look in source number 6, the Chaye Adam, he writes about this, and he has a 10 or 12 different paragraphs where he talks about the strength, the power, and the enforceability of customs, and particularly in Hilchos Pesach, where he's writing about kitnias, he says that it's an impossibility. It's not something that could be abolished, because when it comes to citywide minhagim, when it comes to citywide practices, the Gemara says, B'nei Baishan, Rabbi Yochanan responded, that that's not something that could be abolished, and therefore, as a result, kitnias lasts, and all other citywide minhagim cannot be tinkered and toyed with whatsoever. You'll take a look in source number 5, the Shulchan Aruch seems to pen and note this categorical difference between citywide minhagim versus familial minhagim. Let's read the Shulchan Aruch together. The Shulchan Aruch is found in Siman Reishio Dalet, Sif Beis, and Hilchos Nedarim. The Shulchan Aruch here is quoting the Ramban and the Rivash, who write as follows, Kabbalas HaRabim, if a community accepts as a absolute acceptance by the majority of the city, Chala aleihem v'alzaram. It is accepted and it falls upon them and their descendants. That's it. A kabbalas harabim, meaning once there is a widespread institution and acceptance by the largesse of a particular city or community, it's not something that can be stopped. Ve'afilu bidvarm shlo kibla aleihem b'nei ha'ir b'askama. Even if the city members didn't vote upon it, there wasn't an agreement, there wasn't a unanimous vote where all the members of the city said, we're willing to accept this custom, nonetheless, that customs institution lasts for perpetuity. Ella, shenohagim kein me'atzman lasos geder v'siag l'torah. If the rabbis of the city institute something to be a fence that is coming to support and to protect a Torah halacha, a mitzvah, v'chein habay michutz le'iladusham, somebody enters this city, moves into this particular town. Harehem ke'anshe ha'ir v'chayavim lasos ketakanasam. Somebody moves into the city and the city has a particular practice. That practice has to be kept by each and every single individual in that city as long as it was instituted on a community-wide level. V'af bidvarm shayasur behem b'iram. Even if somebody may have potentially moved from out of town and that particular person didn't have that custom in the city that he came from, you accept the customs of the city that you enter regardless of what the previous city's custom is. So here it seems very clear from the Shulchan Aruch, the Bir HaGra and the Ber HaGola, two of the classic commentaries who source the Psakim of the Shulchan Aruch, indicate from here very clearly that on a citywide level, And on a citywide institution, no customs are permitted to be abolished, and those customs have to be kept. The example, of course, is the kitnius, as I mentioned. But let me share with you another area and synagogue menhagim, shul practices, which also seem to have very similar examples. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he was asked about a particular shul whose membership was dwindling from the original members of the synagogue. The shul was an Ashkenaz shul, and had a very strong Ashkenaz membership, at least in the beginning of its initiation of the shul as it was being born and developed. And slowly the members of that shul began to dwindle. However, a large younger group of a different community started moving into that shul, and they were pushing the rabbi and the leaders of the congregation to switch the nusach ha-tfilah. And their argument was, look, we're now the majority. We have the stronghold of the shul. Just because the shul was instituted and corroborated together as a Ashkenaz shul with Nusach Ashkenaz, who's to say that now the fact that there are a majority of other people who are keeping a different Nusach means that we can't switch it? Rav Moshe responded very powerfully and said, a shul has the rule of a city, and once the shul accepts upon themselves the particular nusach and minag that they have, that minag cannot be changed. Rav Moshe writes very, very eloquently that it's something that's an impossibility, and thus it has the equivalence to a city. A shul has the similarity to a city, and because it was accepted by the rabbin through its origination and the rabbi who began the shul, it's not something that could be moved. Moshe has a similar tshuva where he talks about conflicting practices in a particular shul. If a shul is an Ashkenaz shul, and their custom, for example, on Sukkot is to recite Hoshanos immediately following Shacharis, and slowly the congregation says, you know, we don't want to do that. We want to do it after Musaf, or vice versa. Their custom is really to do it after Musaf, and it's much easier to do Hoshanos after Shacharis, because you already have your Hoshanos out, and you're saying Hallel. Let's just do everything after Hallel. Moshe says, you can't do that. The shul and the community accepted the minhag to keep the minhagim of the particular shul at this moment and at this time, and thus that lasts in perpetuity, and it's impossible to change that particular custom because of the fact that that's considered to be a communally wide accepted custom, and communal minhagim cannot be changed, no different than b'nei baisha. That's when it comes to citywide minhagim. So citywide minhagim, shul practices, and that seems to be the psak of the Shulchan Aruch here in Siman Reish Yudal, the psak of the Chai Adam and Siman Kof Chav Zayin, that when it comes to citywide practices, shul practices, we posit like the Gemara says in source number one, the Chavos Yair and the Pri Chodesh, that citywide minhagim cannot be abolished, and that is the approach that we take. However, what about familial minhagim? So remember back to the tshuva of the Chavos Yair, regarding the father who fasted on Mondays and Thursdays, and the son said, I can't keep up with it. I'm unable to do it. And both the Pri Chodesh and the Chavos Yair said, you could drop it. It's unnecessary, because that's a familial practice. Let's talk for a moment about family minhagim, and when and if, and the propriety potentially for abolishing them. Rav Moshe discusses another Pesach custom, gebrachs, that is a widely debated custom. Of course, the custom stems from the fact that many believe that if you have matzah or matzah meal, potentially that's going to be cooked or mixed with water, it's possible that some of it has not been fully baked, and if it's going to sit out for more than 18 minutes, it's going to rise and it will cause chametz. So there are those, and it was initially instituted by those in the Hasidic community, Hasidic Rebbes, as a custom not to eat what we call gebrachs, what they call in Israel shruya. So Moshe was asked by an individual whether or not I could drop that custom. I'm not interested in keeping the custom of my parents. So if you take a step back for a moment, if you look at the Gemara in source number two, so you would argue, Chala bar chamra legabrei avua. I'm like vinegar, the son of wine, compared to my father. My parents were able to keep this practice. They were able to eat chicken, meat, potatoes, and vegetables for 8 days. I can't. I need to drop it. Rav Moshe, however, writes that you need a good reason to stop keeping your family practice. The Gemara in source number two indicates that there was good reason that the fellow couldn't wait 24 hours from eating meat to eating milk. He needed to have a coffee later in the evening, or he needed something. He wasn't able to fast for 24 hours until he ate milk. Therefore, that was good reason to stop the custom. However, you need to have a good reason, says Rav Moshe, to stop keeping a family custom. It can't be that you want to go to a non-Gebrachs Pesach hotel this year And that's going to be a good reason to stop your family custom. It could be that you have medical issues, or it could be that it's a particular challenge for you when it comes to a relationship within a family or a marriage, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But outside of that Sezer Moshe, it's true that there's a leniency and there's a lower level of enforceability when it comes to a family custom, like the Chavos Yar and the Pri Chodesh say, but at the same time, there needs to be a basis and reason to stop the custom. If there is basis and reason to stop the custom, it could be put to an end with Hataras Nadarim, if there's a good reason, but if not, it cannot simply be stopped. Rav Moshe also talks about shul practices when it comes to family. For example, this is not uncommon. A family davens a particular nusach. Argument's sake, the Ramosha's tshuva is nusach svard. That's somebody's family custom, is that they daven nusach svard. A child, myself, I had this situation. I grew up going to Ashkenazi yeshivas, and nusach svard wasn't a nusach that was davened in the yeshivas that I was going to. So Ramosha was asked by a Rosh Yeshiva in Yerushalayim who had students, where they had this predicament, where they were coming from families who davened Nusach Sfard, but the yeshiva that they davened in was an Ashkenaz yeshiva, or they were going to continue into Ashkenaz communities. Whether or not there was, what was the propriety of changing your family's Nusach? That's the question that Rav Moshe was asked. Rav Moshe notes that this is not a city custom, this is a family custom, because when it comes to your own personal tefillah, when it comes to your own personal nusach, that's something familiarly. When it comes to davening in a community, when it comes to a tzibur, everybody davens together, and everybody who is somebody who has a different custom than the shul that they daven in should daven with the custom that the shul has. But what about changing my nusach? Can I change my family nusach? So Rav Moshe again writes that it's not so simple, but Rav Moshe does allow it if there's good reason. There needs to be a good reason. Rav Moshe felt, a topic for a different time, the Nusach Ashkenaz was more of an authoritative Nusach. That's a separate subject. But Rav Moshe therefore writes that as a result, this individual can change the Nusach from Nusach Svarad to Nusach Ashkenaz if there's a good basis. The good basis in this particular situation is that the fellow was always going to be part of the Ashkenaz community. So for him to always be davening Nusach Svarad, even though that was his father and grandfather and great-grandfather's custom, if he's always part of a community where they're davening Nusach Ashkenaz, it wouldn't be the right thing, and therefore Moshe allowed this student to change from Nusach Svarad to Nusach Ashkenaz. So again, you see the split and the categorical difference between city customs and familial customs. On the one hand, the Moshe said, you can't change the shul's nusach. That's impossible, even though the membership is dwindling. And even though the larger members of the shul are now davening in nusach, a tefillah that's different than the way it was instituted in the shul. Once it was instituted on a community-wide level, it cannot be abolished. However, when it comes to a private nusach, when it comes to my family's custom, that's something that potentially, if there is reason to change it, it can be changed. So far what we've really tried to flesh out is the categorical difference between citywide minhagim and shul minhagim on the one hand, familial customs on the other hand. City minhagim, i.e. kitnias, nusach hatfilah of a shul, cannot be tinkered and toyed and abolished, as opposed to familial customs, which can, with a good reason. If there are any questions... Good question. So Rav Moshe Feinstein addresses that question also, and he says that an individual who has a different custom in the shul that he or she is davening in should daven in the publicly in the minyan that they are in, like the minig of the particular shul. Only in areas where you're saying something aloud. For example, let's take Kedusha, for example. Nusach Svarad says Naritzcha or Keser by Musaf, and Nusach Achshna says Nekadesh and Naritzcha. So what do I do if I have a different custom? So Moshe says when it comes to the public areas, when you say something aloud, you should say it like the congregation says it. When it comes to the private areas, for example, Psuki de Zimra, where Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Sfarad have a different way to begin and to conclude, that I could say to myself because that's not affecting the broader congregation. But when it comes to saying things out loud, including the Filas Apayim, Tachnun, and banging the Yud Gimel Midos, Rav Moshe says that should be said like the Tzibur because it's a large community, and you have to do what the broad shul is doing. Privately is different. One of my rabbeim, actually, Ashkenazi, who married a woman from a Hasidish family, was Davin Nusach Sfarad, went to the Stipler Gaon, Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, and they wanted to know whether the woman who was marrying the Ashkenazi rabbi, whether or not she had to change her Nusach HaTfilah. So we're not talking about private, we're not talking about public, we're talking about whether a woman who marries and has a different custom than her husband-to-be has to change her custom. Listen to what the Stipler said. The Stipler Gaon said, everybody davens in the Nusach that is most comfortable to them. Because if you grow up davening for 18, 20, 30 years in your personal way, to change that, even based upon marriage, said the Stipler that it's not necessary. So therefore, she kept on davening Nusach Ashkenaz, he davens Nusach, she davened Nusach Sfarad, he davened Nusach Ashkenaz. The children probably, based upon the yeshivas that they grew up in, davened in that particular Nusach where they were trained, and therefore there was a split on a private level on the house. If there's time permitting, we could talk a little bit more about conflicting practices between husband and wife. But on a global level, that is the approach that we take. That publicly we have to do everything together, and that's the citywide minhagim. Privately, there's more room to amend. Yeah?
So you said that a communal or shul-wide that's been accepted is in perpetuity. Can that ever be changed if it's accepted to change it on the same level which
is accepted? Very good question. There seems to be indication, it actually is a machlokes achronim, whether that's permitted. The Pri Chadash actually comments that maybe, arguably, the reason why the people of Bishon were prohibited from changing the customs because those were only descendants. And descendants can't change something that their ancestors took upon themselves. But if a community establishes something and that same community wants to abolish it, there's potential to do that. But it has to be on an even playing field. So descendants who are following their ancestors' practices, they can't abolish a citywide practice. That's B'nai Bishon. But if the city members themselves who established a custom, there would be an argument that they themselves could. Not everybody agrees. But if you take a look in Rav Moshe's tshuva regarding the shul wanting to switch from one nusach to another nusach, so Rav Moshe didn't allow that. And again, that's probably because of the fact that it was instituted by a majority group, and that majority group was no longer. Maybe if the institution kept its membership and those people said, you know what, it's time to change for a particular good reason, it could be an argument can be made that yes. But if you take a look, for example, Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Chacham Tzvi, when they were talking about Kinyas, the Chacham Tzvi indicates that if there were rabbis who were willing to join force with him, he seems to entertain the possibility that you could abolish Kinyas. So he does have, there is a implicit statement, but however, that never took place. And never has Kinyas really ever been abolished in the Ashkenazi community. As I mentioned, the great rabbis in the 1800s, before Rabbi Yaakov Emden and the Chacham Tzvi, also did not allow that to take place.
What if there's a family minhag, but the alternative that the person wants to switch to is a much stronger halakhic basis? Like, for example, I mean, this is not a good example. What I'm thinking of is, let's say, eating on the Sukkot Shmini Atzeres, which seems to be a much stronger basis for doing so. The person's minhag is not to.
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. What we have, it's really a topic in and of itself, but the short answer is it depends if it's a minhag or if it's a halacha. When you talk about sitting in the sukkah on the eighth day, it's not really an issue of a minhag. The Gemara has a very strong comment about that, and the Gemara seems to indicate, and I'm not getting into this issue because it's a hot topic, and before I know it, I'm going to be, I'm going to get myself in very hot water here. But that's an issue of halacha. I'll give you another example just to flesh this out. There are different minhagim, quote-unquote, that people have for sitting or standing for Kiddush. Let's say somebody says, I don't want to keep my father's practice of sitting, or I don't want to keep my father's practice for standing. So is that permitted or is that not permitted? Well, it depends. Is it a minhag or is it a halacha? You have to answer that question. When it comes to a minhag, so if it's a family minhag, so if there's good reason and good basis to stop it, it can be. But what's the reason for, maybe you'll tell me that I can't stand so long to say vayichulu, or it hurts me to sit for a long time. Then certainly there's room to change it. But if it's a halacha, the halacha says to sit, and the halacha says to stand, and there's a debate between Ashkenaz and Sfarad what to do, then I could have a different psak halacha than my father. Minhagim have a strength of enforcement because it's a minhag. Al titosh taras imecha. But when it comes to a halacha, if I have a different halacha, and I understand the halacha differently than my father, there's nothing that binds me to keep that. And that's really an important difference, and this will be discussed in the first year, what the difference between halacha and minhag is. And this is a point where that really emerges.
What I'd like to do now, with the time remaining, is to talk about quickly two minhagim of Shavuos. And I believe there might be a point here which speaks really to this distinction between familial customs versus communal customs. If you turn the page to the other side, source number 6 is the Ramah. The Ramah quotes two very well-known minhagim of Shavuos. The first, Noagin l'shtoach asavim b'shavuos b'beis ha'knesses v'abatim. There's a custom to place shrubbery, greenery, in the shuls on Shavuos, v'habatim, and in homes. Zeichel l'simchas matan Torah. Indication from the Pesukim in Parshas Yisro, and the Midrashim fleshed this out, that there was significant shrubbery and greenery at the Mount Sinai, at Har Sinai, and therefore, in order to relive, to commemorate Matan Torah and Shavuos, we again place shrubbery, greenery, trees, and the like in our homes and in our shuls on Shavuos. That's what the Ramah says. Second custom. Noagim b'chol makom lechol ma'achol echolav b'yom rishon Shavuos. It's a custom b'chol makom, everywhere, to eat the dairy on the first day of Shavuos. These customs, I would imagine, are somewhat well known to you. Each of these customs received significant opposition. Each. And most notably, the first custom, the custom to place shrubbery, greenery, and the like on Shavuos, was strongly opposed by none other than the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu Mivilna, the great Ashkenazi luminary, who said that it's inappropriate to place shrubbery, greenery, and the like, both in shuls and in homes, because of the Isser D'Araisa, the Lav of Bichukoseihem Lo Seilechu. It's following in the statutes of non-Jews. If you go to faiths, other faiths, places of worship, that's something that they do. Therefore, it's inappropriate for us to do that because then we're imitating non-Jewish customs. Now, there is a lot to talk about here, and I really can't get into great depth. It's a chapter in the book. But there's enormous conflict when it comes to this particular practice, to place or not to place. Yes, shrubbery, yes, shrubbery, no greenery. What's interesting to note is that here you have a tension between a custom and a halacha, and maybe not even a halacha, an isser d'oraisa, of placing a statute or following in the ways of the non-Jews. So the Vilna Gaon, although he didn't write anything in his own pen about this in the Bir Agra on Shulchan Aruch, it's quoted by his students, most notably in the Sefer Maaseh Rav, of a collection of the practices and customs of the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon's position was not to do so. Therefore, we're in a quandary. What's the minhag? What do we do? Do we place or do we not place? The Ramah says that that is the custom in homes and in shuls. And the Ramah wasn't the first person to say this. It goes well back to the Mahril, to the Kolbo, and to earlier Yesharim from 1,000 years ago that there was a very strong custom to place greenery and shrubbery in shuls and in homes. The Vilna Gaon, writing 300, 400, 500 years later, said, no, you can't do that. What do we do? The second custom, eat dairy on Shavuos. The Ramah writes on the first day. And again, probably today you could collect close to 30 to 40 reasons as to why we eat dairy on Shavuos. I don't know if there are more answers to the Beis Yosef's question or why we celebrate 8 days of Hanukkah because of the fact that there was enough oil on day one, should celebrate it 7, or why there are more reasons for eating milk on Shavuos. I think there's a Sefer that publishes 101 answers to the question of Hanukkah. I know some 30 answers to why the custom developed to eat milk on Shavuos, the most famous one, which is the most well-known but is hardest to source, which I imagine most of you are familiar with, is that after the Jews received the Torah, they were beginning to keep the laws of kosher. They had to learn the halachas of shechita, of nikur, of tvilas kelim, hagalas kelim, basar v'chalav. How can we keep all these halachas? The Jewish people just received the Torah, so they were told, it's impossible. We can't separate between meat and milk, so they started only eating dairy. That's the reason that the Mishnah Berurah quotes from a Chacham Echad, from a Gadol Echad, he doesn't cite who. A lot of discussion amongst scholars as to who this Chacham is and why the Chafetz Chaim doesn't say who's the reason behind this. But there are other notable reasons as well as to why we eat milk on Shavuos as well. Nonetheless, this custom also received significant opposition and question. The first is that we know that there's a halacha, and I'll talk about this halacha, that you should really eat meat on Yom Tov. The Rambam writes that on Yom Tov you should eat meat. Now, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't paskin that, and he argues with the Rambam. And the Shulchan Aruch never says that you're required to eat poultry, chicken, or meat on Yom Tov. There's no rule, there's no halakha that you have to. Nonetheless, the question existed for many that did have that practice to eat meat and poultry on Shavuos. How could you tell me to eat milk? We've been eating meat for tens of years. Now, all of a sudden, you're supposed to eat milk? And if you are supposed to eat milk, how are we going to deal with the separation between milk and meat? And in Eretz Yisrael, they only kept one day. So within one day, you want me to eat milk and to eat meat? What about the Gemara in Chulin that says I have to wait 24 hours? It's an impossibility. I do want to point out something jarring and very racy, but the Mikubalim said that on Shavuos, all of the rules of milk and meat are fall by the wayside. And you don't have to wait between eating meat and eating milk on Shavuos. You could wait a short amount of time, worth it to come to the shiur just to hear that. Or you could simply eat milk and meat together on some level. If you look in the Hasidic Svarim and the Kabbalistic Svarim, which I don't understand, they give reasons that are beyond my pay grade and above my pay grade. But at the end of the day, there are those customs. The Rishonim, even the Kolbo, suggests that there's a shorter waiting period. The Chok Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, in his commentary on Hilchos Pesach, notes this, that maybe you could allow the potential to eat both meat and milk on Shavuos because you could do away with the separation that's classically required. However, many of the halakha commentators said, that's not true, you can't do that. And some suggested, no, you should do. You should eat meat, bench, and then after you bench, wash out your mouth and then eat milk. So commentaries said, halachic says that that's called a bracha shelo tzricha. I'm making a bracha, berchas hamazon, in order just to fulfill the minug. That doesn't make sense. There's enormous tension between the minug, to eat milk on Shavuos, and the halacha of how I deal with meat and milk. There's enormous tension between the shrubbery, the greenery in the homes and in the shuls on Shavuos, whether or not you should do that or should not do that. How do we deal with customs that conflict with halacha? How are we going to handle that? I'd like to show this morning, in the time we have, that there seems to be that halachic authorities say that there's a difference between the form of the minhag. If you take a look in source number 8, the Chut Meshulash is a biography written by the grandson of the Chassam Sofer, who recounts the following story. Chassam Sofer, of course, the rabbi of Pressburg, the leading Hungarian authority, came to shul one Shavuos and found that there was no shrubbery placed in his synagogue. Any of you know the Chassam Sofer, you would probably run very quickly if that was what happened. The Chassam Sofer had a somewhat of a chuppah, a canopy that was built by his seat in the Beis Medrash before Shavuos. And the Chassam Sofer was a strong individual who felt that the custom of shrubbery had to be kept. He entered the shul the evening of Shavuos, and as it's quoted in the Chut Meshulash, a play on words, Manishtana Halayla Hazeh, what happened? Where was the gabbai? Where was the community? Why was there no shrubbery in the synagogue the evening of Shavuos? And he says as follows in the last line, Umatza hakpeda makum lachalalav vlohishlim shnaso. The gabbai that year did not finish the year. So the Chassam Sofer felt that that practice was very important. And the fact that the shrubbery and greenery was not placed was enough of a reason to have a kpeda, to have a reason on that particular person or people or committee that didn't place the shrubbery in the shul that year. Story number one. Number two, in source number 9, the Divrei Shul, Rabbi Nathausen, author of the Shul Meshiv, many Achronim quote this source, and he had the following practice. His community seemed to have followed the custom to place greenery and shrubbery in the shul. However, he began to recognize that the custom of the Vilna Gaon and the position of the Vilna Gaon not to place shrubbery was taking root. And he has a great halachic authority. The Shul Meshiv was a person who sent responsa to numerous, multiple people in his country and beyond. Try to understand what should he do. The Gra on the one hand said not to, is a lav in Isra D'Oraisa not to place greenery and shrubbery. On the other hand, this was the practice of the city, of the community for a long time. What did he do? He sent people from his shul to go to different houses of worship and to check what do they do. And he went to different houses of worship through members of his community, checking, does this church place greenery? Does this church place shrubbery? Does this church put trees in their shul? He wanted to understand. Because if it was a practice of a church or of another faith to do so, then it's true, it would be a problem of bichukosei moseleiku. But if they simply put it there for ornamental reasons or for decorative reasons, the Shul Meshiv understood that that wouldn't be a problem. So if you take a look in source number 9, 3 lines from the bottom, he says, Tzivisi lishol, I instructed, mehagoyim al mahem osimzos. Why do they place shrubbery, greenery in their houses of worship? V'hayishishim behem, and the older members of the other faiths explained to the emissaries and to the proxies that the Shaul Meshuv sent out, shehigilem shein rak mishum kavod v'hidur habayis beitzim. They wanted to make the church pretty and nice, so they put trees and the like. V'imkein hekesh asechel mechayvo v'im bo mishum darche amori ad kan l'shono. And therefore the Shaul Meshuv paskin that if they're only placing this as ornamental and as beautifying their places of worship, there's no problem with chukosem lo selechu, and thus the Shaul Meshuv posited to continue the practice. So you see, both the Chasam Sofer as well as the Shaul Meshuv, Rabbi Nathausen, understood that this is a practice that has to be kept. What was bothering them? Why did the Shaul Meshuv send emissaries? Why did the Chasam Sofer feel so strongly about this custom? I would argue because based upon the language of the Ramah, who says that it was a minig of the shul, of a Beis HaKnesses. It was a citywide custom. And when you're talking about something that was instituted on a communal level, on a shul level, you can't just drop it. What's the big deal? So you have the trees, you have the shrubbery, you have the greenery. Leave it. Put it up. What's the big issue? They understood that something that's instituted on a communal level cannot be abolished and cannot be dropped. Therefore, the Chasam Sofer had his kepeda, had his issues with a gabbai who didn't place it, and therefore the Shaul Meshuv sent emissaries to find it out. On the other hand, if you take a look in source number 10, the Darkei Tshuva, the Munkacher Rav, he discusses at great length the propriety of eating milk and meat on Shavuos. And he says, we find ourselves with a lot of issues, halachic problems, whether or not you can eat meat and milk together, whether or not you can make a bracha, shelo letzorach, you can make a bracha for no reason, because you want to be able to bench and then you'll eat your meat, or then you'll eat your milk. What are you going to do? So Munkacher Rav quotes the Svarim of the Orach Mishor and the Toras Chaim, says, you know what? Drop it. Leave the custom. Leave the custom of eating milk. It's not such a big deal. It's not a big deal. What about the minhag to place shrubbery and greenery in the shuls? That is a big deal. I would say that when it comes to the minhag of eating milk, that's a familial custom. That's not a citywide practice. And when it comes to familial minhagim, if there's a good reason and a good basis to stop and to drop the custom, then it can be dropped. So therefore, that's what the Munkacher Rav says, that when it comes to the minhag of eating milk on Shavuos, and the problem, the halachic issues that you have with it, says the Munkacher Rav, drop it, don't deal with it, and leave it, and therefore, as a result, his position was to let it go. What I think you see when it comes to these two areas of halacha, minhage mishpach and minhage ir, there's a significant difference when it comes to them. And thus, the Shaul Meshuv and the Chasam Sofer felt very strongly and very powerfully that you can't drop the custom to put the greenery in the shul. Because if it's established on a communal level, no different than B'nai Baisha, the Gemara in Pesachim, and Daf Nun, you can't let it go. But when it comes to a family custom, like the Chavos Yar and the Pri Chodesh said, that's the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Kuf Dalet, that's something that can be dropped for a good basis. So to flesh it out, you see these two customs of Shavuos, the minhag of Achilas Chalav and the minhag of Simas Asavim in the Beis HaKnesses, really speak to two particular customs. And that's the reason I believe that the Ramah writes in his gloss to Shulchan Aruch that the minhag was B'Beis HaKnesses, in the shul. Because the shul has a very powerful standing as a city. And once a shul has the custom, that's not something that can toy and tinker with, as opposed to familial custom with good reason can be tinkered with. Maybe just to close, although there's a significant difference between the minhagim of eating milk and meat on Shavuos and the minhag of placing shrubbery in the shuls, there is a common denominator. Shavuos is a holiday where the Torah tells us in Parshas Veschanan that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to Klal Yisrael, it was a Kol Hashem Lo Yosaf. There was the voice that HaKadosh Baruch Hu emanated in giving the Aseres HaDibros never stopped. And the grammatical language Lo Yosaf means that it never stopped, it continues forever. These two minhagim and minhagim in general try to relive and to re-experience the Chag in a whole different way. So placing or not placing, eating milk or not eating milk, that's a minhag and halachic issue of technicality that you have to deal with. But what you do see from a broader level and from a larger spectrum is that minhagim are here to really explain to us and to express to us and to reach and to appreciate what the Yom Tov is about. So when you place greenery and when you eat milk, it's supposed to allow us to relive the Yom Tov that we're entering. And therefore on Shavuos, it's not just that we're commemorating Matan Torah, but we're reliving it. It's Kol Hashem Lo Yosef. Every single person, when they study Torah, the Gemara says, Maseches Gittin, Dav Zayin, that when there was a debate that the Amoraim had about a particular case, they said that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is saying this in Shemayim, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu is saying this in Shemayim. Because when a person studies Torah, the Torah is not a past. The Torah is right now. The Torah that we're living and breathing, the Torah that we're studying, the Torah that we're teaching is a Torah that's alive. Matan Torah wasn't in the past. Matan Torah is right now. And that's what these two minhagim are allowing us to appreciate. It's not just that we do play shabri or don't play shabri, but it speaks to reliving the experience of Matan Torah, and that's something unique about Shavuos, a little bit different than Pesach and Sukkot, which are a bit more commemorative. But Shavuos, we relive Matan Torah. The experience of Matan Torah should be something that we're able to relive and to cherish and to pass on from generation to generation. Wishing everybody a good early good yontif. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Sure. So that will depend upon a machlokes achronim, whether or not descendants are permitted to abolish earlier customs. There are those who understand that there is potential for that, if there's good reason to do that. There are others who say once it was established and it can never be abolished whatsoever. So it's a machlokas. Kinyas is a good example of that. Shul is a good example of that. And Moshe, you can't get a better argument. The shul membership has completely flipped. And Moshe still said you can't. Happy to take any other questions, publicly or privately. Yeah?
What about the 33 days of mourning during
Sukkot? It's a good question. I was going to talk about that, but the time is late. The Rama writes that a city that... The question was the 33 days of mourning between Pesach and Shavuos. There are different customs that people have. The first 33, the latter 33. The Rama writes that if a city has a custom, everybody has to keep that custom. The problem happens, and Moshe writes this in a tshuva, today we live in a world of melting pot Jewry, where you come from Hungary, you come from Poland, you come from Lithuania, you come from Russia, and I come from America, and everybody has a different custom. So is there really one bona fide communal practice is an excellent question. It's a hard question, a topic for a different time. But if a city, if a small constituency does have a particular custom, that custom should be kept, and everybody in that city should keep that particular custom.
What if your shul has a certain custom?
It depends what the custom is. I mean, that's the difference between shrubbery. I mean, just because your shul puts up shrubbery doesn't mean you have to do that in your house. Right.
Has grown to include the quinoa and things that were never even breathing.
So that's a halachic question, how you define kinyas, which is a very good question, and it really is a topic for another shir, but it's not really a question of minug, it's what is kinyas? That's a new shir. And it's a good question. Quinoa, peanuts, and the like, are Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about, are peanuts kinyas, are they not kinyas? Quinoa contemporary poskim are dealing with that. That the question is really going back to the source. Why were kitnios established? What's the reason for it? And if those reasons apply to newer age kitnios on this side of the Atlantic Ocean? Good question. But there are those who say that the Gonim only prohibited particular foods. So that's it. There is an argument to make. Yashikoch. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.